It's like a maze, really, all these channels. We're careful not to get lost.
Oh, no, we won't. No, and I'm determined not to go back until we discover something more definite. We only have one phenomenon and this mystery.
Ball to open.
Ball to open.
Yes, and what do you do?
One swipe of its paw would smash us to pieces. Don't relax.
Here come the drums!
So here it comes, the sound of drums. Here come the drums, here come the drums.
Hello! Hello! And welcome once again to Ball to Open, an ongoing quest to watch every single televised story of Doctor Who in entirely random order. My name's Chris Taylor.
My name's Pete Paschal, and Chris and I are a couple of guys who have been doing this random journey throughout Doctor Who since long before the podcast existed. And we've decided to concentrate all of our thoughts on Doctor Who, our commentary, into audio form, and now video form if you're watching us on YouTube.
Indeed. And
the universe demanded it. I tell you.
The randomizer demands it, and what the randomizer wants, the randomizer gets. And previously on Pull to Open, the randomizer, three journeys to random stories ago, took us to The Runaway Bride, which, as you may have heard in our previous episode, was actually the reason for David Tennant and Catherine Tate and RTD to reunite for the 60th anniversary special. 2 episodes ago took us to Dalek, that fantastic Chris Eccleston episode that we love so much, that reintroduced the Daleks, or reintroduced a Dalek. And then last time we went to that Matt Smith story that maybe you didn't remember happened, The Beast Below, aka the one with the whale. And that takes us to another one that I definitely wouldn't have watched if the randomizer hadn't taken us here. It is all the way back to season 2 of the original show, the first serial, Planet of Giants.
Ooh, and big giants.
Not one I'd seen before. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you go back way further than your previously recap, if you go back to like last year, we did the Sensorites.
We did. Right?
That was our first Hartnell. And oh no, it was our second.
Second. We did the rescue. We did the rescue, and then I think we did the Sensorites.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But this comes immediately after the Sensorites, yes.
Two after. I thought it did two, and then I realized the Reign of Terror actually closes out soon.
Oh, right. In terms of available stories. Available stories on BritBox currently. Comes immediately after. But
we're on the planet, of giants, which, spoiler alert, is Earth.
Oh, no. Well, thanks. Now I don't know. I did watch it. It's the first return to Earth after an unearthly child took us
away. Seemingly contemporary Earth. This is also the first. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I checked the episode guide in the Codex. It's the only 3-episoder of the entire classic series.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. And it's kind of interesting because we're being told, as we mentioned in our special episode, that the anniversary special is, of course, that we're getting 3 specials, and they seem to be tying together to tell a story. So here is the randomizer celebrating the 3-episode story in advance of the special. So once again, the randomizer ahead of the curve.
Impressive. Wow. It's very numerically consistent. I love it. All right. Well, we're going to get to it. All the giant stuff, all the planet stuff. But first, let's go into the Pull to Open feedback loop, which, of course, always starts with reviews. So, guys, if you have not left one of those things, one of those reviews, you have not joined the privileged class of Pull to Open listeners who get their reviews read out on the podcast.
Yeah.
You need to leave one to hear one, I guess, is the takeaway from that. So I would love to read your review. You've got to leave it. You got to go to the Apple Podcast Store or whatever service you're on and assuming it can take reviews, not many can. But if it can, please leave a review. It really will help the show, because the more reviews a podcast gets, the more visibility it will have when people search for, say, Doctor Who podcast in their podcast app.
So indeed. And also, and to make it more fun, leave an emoji review, which is what our fans have been doing. And they've been stumping us with it. So you have that delight.
So a couple things. Yes, this has become our default way for people to leave us emoji titles. That is Doctor Who episode titles in the style of emojis, which we can now report are in our codec. So the Pull to Open codec, which powers our randomizer, has had an upgrade recently. And all the emoji reviews we've gotten in so far are now on those line items. So go ahead, check the show notes, go click over, have a look. So if you leave an emoji review or emoji title, you will get immediately thrown into the codec. So more incentive to do so. And someone has done so.
Yes.
I'd love to read that out here.
Oh my God, are you going to tease me again? We had this as our segment before The Beast Below, in which Pete read out the emoji reviews. I was stumped by the Macroterra, but then I got Trial of the Time Lord. Was I correct on Trial of the Time Lord? Yes.
I think you were, yes. Mm. You definitely nailed that one. I mean, you made up for your loss. I mean, the Macra, come on. The
Macra. Yeah, you had
Congrats,
to
Macra.
Lead me. Macra, yeah, yeah. If you haven't seen Macroterra, the connection between Macra and crabs, not necessarily the first thing that comes to mind.
It's a Lost episode. I don't know if they ever animated it, though. Mm. I don't think they did. Mm.
And then the second one was Remembrance of the Dalek. You really had to lead me to water on that one.
You really had to get a thinking emoji to get the thinking emoji in that title, yes. But you got Trial of a Time Lord, so Chris, are you ready? Do you feel good? Do you feel like you've worked that emoji brain that you can get this?
Yeah.
One?
Yeah. I mean, it's only one. Okay. All right. Bring it on.
First, I want to thank Father Time Lord for leaving this review, as well as the 5 stars. Thank you so much.
Good name.
Someone from the United States. That's all the demographic information I have. It's only a title. So here we go. 4 emojis. First emoji, plunger.
Dalek.
Second emoji, octopus.
Inside the Dalek.
Third emoji, takeout container.
Yeah.
Emoji, skyline.
Ooh, takeout container. I mean, is the first two make me think of into the Dalek.
Well, you got the plunger and the octopus, which I think together make Dalek, right?
Make Dalek. Yeah, that's one way of saying Dalek. The takeout container, the takeout night of the Daleks. God, I'm just now thinking about food, like the Chinese meal
of the
Daleks.
Slumber party of the Daleks.
The overly MSG added food order of the Daleks. Wow.
Okay, you see, come on, I know you got this. So you got Dalek.
Yeah.
Takeout container. Skyline. So city skyline.
City skyline is its... see, the trouble is I can't automatically recall all of the Dalek names of episodes, right? You know, obviously I've got Remembrance stuck in my head. I've got Day. I've got Death. I've got, you know, Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Yeah, can I give you a hint?
Yeah.
New Who.
New Who, okay. Is it... It's not Asylum of the Daleks. They don't get food in the sun. Skyline City? No. Oh, God. I mean, Into the Dalek was my best guess, and I'm just sort of stuck on that with the takeout container.
Think of how many Dalek stories have the actual name of a city in the title.
Oh, God. Oh, my head is totally going blank on that. I don't know the London Vacation of the Daleks.
Well, this is also how many. Oh, I've already given you so many hints, and I know that the audience is like but it's like how many Dalek
I'm
titles?
I'm so sorry, everyone. So sorry.
How many Dalek titles start with the word Dalek? Because this is in the correct order.
Oh God, Daleks Take Manhattan. Oh my God, that is the, literally the first time I've had to think of Daleks Take Manhattan since it actually aired. So,
I'm
yeah.
Sure Father Time Lord owes you an apology for that. And we owe them thanks. Thank you very much, Father Time Lord. That was amazing. Really,
I love the idea of the Daleks taking Manhattan to go. It's like, yeah, could you just put that in a box, please? Could we get a doggy bag?
I always kind of figure that whenever I heard the expression takes Manhattan, that for some reason that's always been in my head. Maybe it's just me having been raised on superhero comics where that was a possibility that someone could actually take the island of Manhattan and put it somewhere. But whenever I hear someone taking Manhattan, I just think of the literal act of doing that. It's, I don't know why. I'm weird.
Please bag this island up for us. We could not destroy it all. We will destroy it later at home.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Father Time Lord. Really appreciate it again.
Oh, I'm so sorry, fans.
Emoji title at your leisure.
Yeah, if you too would like to stump me and if you would also like to scream the episode title at a podcast while I am desperately making up Doctor Who story names, then please leave us an emoji review.
Alrighty, moving on to the feedback loop. YouTube is continuing to grow. We're at youtube.com/pulltoopen. All of our social media short videos and our plot summaries are there. Our older episodes that we never cut to video are still coming most Wednesdays. And of course, the new stuff is coming Saturdays. Great comments all the time there. I know. Great comments on YouTube. What? I think YouTube was waiting for Pull to Open to be there before all the good commenters came out. Thanks so much, everyone, for commenting, interacting with us there. Really love it. Keep it coming. But guys, the real story in the feedback loop this time is TikTok. We had what I can only call a Dalek boom on TikTok since we did Dalek. And then we kind of knew we had a good episode there, not just of the show, obviously, but of the podcast. I mean, we really like, I mean, Dalek is such a legendary episode. It's a Viscount banger, if there ever was one. And we really wanted to deliver like really thoughtful commentary and good stuff there. And I cut a lot of videos for that particular podcast. And I got to thank fans there on TikTok because we were rewarded with a large degree of virality. Many of the videos just have thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of views. So thanks so much, everyone, for sharing those, watching them, commenting. We've had so many comments. It's been great. And we got a lot of new followers. We're at well over 8,500 followers now. We're closing in on 10K again, closing on 9K rather, but 10K is obviously the milestone that we're looking forward. Once we reach 10K, we're definitely going to do something special for you all. So. First, very heartfelt thanks to everyone on TikTok for following us there. And if you're not, we're at Pull to Open on TikTok, all one word. Go ahead and follow us there. Give us some comments. It's good stuff.
Yeah, and we're closing in on 9,000 followers there. We've already said we were going to do something special for 10,000. So come along and join the party. Join the party. do we regenerate our clothes? I don't know what happens. But yeah, we'll do something. We'll do something.
So
thank you.
We have
everyone.
A bunch of comments on the Dalek videos, of course. I there were just so many to choose from in terms of our TikTok comment of the week. But I've got a few here. I'll get through as many as I can before I feel like we're just stalling for Planet of Giants, because I don't know who's doing TLDW this week.
That would be you.
But here we go. I want to give a few comments from the Dalek videos. Their Time in the Sun. And the first one is from Wildman793.
Wow,
it says, someone like me whose first introduction to the concept as a whole, it's very important that I understood what Dalek could do. Such a great episode. And this was on the video where we talk about the Dalek is just a normal Dalek. It's just a typical Dalek. It's not like special in any way. Mm-hmm. So that was an important aspect of this being not, you know, it's just it shows a soldier Dalek.
Yeah.
And
yep.
There's a second comment which follows this, which is sort of in the same vein. It's on the same video. It says, really shows what a Time War area Dalek was capable of. And was my first introduction to them. Always introduce Daleks to new people with this episode.
And
yeah, the Time War aspect is interesting because, of course, it is. Like, even for classic fans, it was like a reintroduction to Daleks and what Daleks had become during the Time War. Like, what it was almost like they'd evolved because of the Time War. And so it wasn't like old fans were kind of rolling their eyes going, yeah, of course, we know Daleks can do all this. It was a twist for everyone. So, yeah, that's an important point.
Yeah, and it's also like, I think, to see the Daleks sort of realized as they kind of always should have been to some extent, this is a great jumping on point for new people to the show to get them to understand the show, sort of its background, and also to kind of like take this villain seriously. Because if you, you know, there's other good examples of that in New Who, but I think none better than this one. So unless you think that's kind of ruining the Daleks for people, because... high watermark. I still think it's this guy's got a point. This is a good jumping on point for non-fans.
Indeed. And speaking of points, we have a point about the Dalek's balls.
So we cut another video about the Dalek self-destruct mechanism that you see in Dalek where the balls come out and blow it up. And this TikToker, who is Sligly Fubgubbler, I don't want to speculate, says... The balls are shield generators. In that self-destruct scene, the balls aren't doing the blowing up, just contain the explosion. And I actually replied to this person, asked, well, why would it want to contain the explosion? And they reply, to ensure total destruction. If the explosion was not contained, energy would be wasted, much like simply burning gunpowder, but put it in a container, well... And I like this explanation, I have to say.
So it was to ensure Dalek suicide, basically?
Yeah, so they blow up and it ensures, I think, that you don't have fragments of Dalek technology lying around that other races could take and then exploit, which actually makes a lot of sense. And it also gives me the explanation that I was saying, which is that, well, why would you just walk around with a self-destruct mechanism just exposed to everyone all the time? And it's like, well... It isn't that, it's the shields, and that explains the shields, you know, that you see, that it has essentially deflector shields that vaporize bullets and whatever else, but it's kind of a neat explanation. I like it. Until I hear a better one, I'm going with this.
I mean, if there is a self-destruct mechanism on Daleks, it's sort of weird that we haven't seen it before, right? And what we have seen before, time and time again, is the Dalek casing just left littered all over the landscape.
True.
So maybe my new headcanon is that this Dalek was we know from the novelization it was a very young Dalek. Maybe it was more environmentally conscious.
And, like, it's one of those activist Daleks. Totally.
Yeah, he's just like, yeah, I'm just gonna, you know, no muss, no fuss. I'm not gonna leave anything behind. I'm not going to be a burden after I'm gone. But yeah, I mean, all you can say is, you know, look at the balls on that Dalek.
I'm going to leave it there. I can't top all look at the balls of that Dalek. Good stuff. Thank you all commenters. Wish we could have time for more because there are so many, but go ahead and check them out. Pull to Open on TikTok. Of course, we are at Pull to Open 63 on other platforms, namely Instagram and Twitter. Please follow us there as well. We're also sharing videos. We're also interacting on Twitter for as long as Twitter is with us. And we'd love to hear on any of those platforms, whether you want to give us an emoji title or not.
Yeah, if you're listening to this far in the future, Twitter was a platform in which we sent short messages to each other. Then some guy decided he wanted to buy it. And
way overpaid for it, I will say.
Way overpaid for it. And I'm sure it's a cautionary tale by the time you're listening to it.
Alrighty.
But yes, we are a podcast.
Lots of other things we could talk about. We did talk about in our episode last week. So we are going to, guys, Planet of Giants is the episode where we just cut right to it.
That's right. I can hear you. I can hear the fans screaming, get to Planet of Giants, because there's such a demand for this story, this famous story in Doctor Who. No, of course it's not. It is a very forgotten story. We may find out that is for a good reason. If you know of it, you probably know that it's the one with the sort of the outsized props. You may have seen pictures of it. You know, might be memorable for that reason. But yeah, otherwise not really well known. So it's sort of, you know, this is what the randomizer does. It takes us to every story in Doctor Who history, every single one, even the forgotten episodes, which the three episodes of Planet of the Giants certainly are. But we always start off with TLDW, too long Doctor Who, too long, didn't watch. Definitely both applicable in this instance. Wherein one of us attempts
to
summarize.
Okay?
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Open mind. I have a lot of good things to say about this. But we start off with 30 seconds per Classic Who episode to summarize. And Planet of the Giants is, as we've mentioned, an unusual three-parter, the only three-parter of the classic series, right? So for the only time, I believe, in Paul to Open history, Pete, since you're doing TLDW, you have a minute and a half.
Wow.
To summarize. Now, I'm prepared to give you, if you feel like you need a little extra time, we could make this 2 minutes because it was actually shot as four episodes. So I'm prepared to be generous if you feel like you need it. But how do you feel about this?
I'm not sure I even need a minute 30, but maybe that sounds really arrogant considering how I've done in previous TLDWs. No, I think I got this. Minute 30. Let's do minute 30.
All right. Well, then. Are you ready, sir? Have you closed all your tabs?
I'm kind of not, but I kind of am, as always. That's how you feel. Like, I actually watched this episode further in the past than normal because we had a bit of a bye week, and we did our special regeneration episode as well as the last one we just did. So I'm going to have to rack my brain to sort of remember the play-by-play, but it's pretty straightforward. I mean...
So, all right. Well, you're confident. I like your confidence.
Quick sip of water, and I'm ready.
All right. Let's see if it's warranted as we begin the official pull to open summary of Planet of Giants in 3, 2, 1, go.
So the Doctor is trying to get back to contemporary Earth because that's, again, where Ian and Barbara are from. But what happens? Oh, the doors to the ship, the TARDIS, open while they're in flight, which does something. It busts the scanner. They can't see what's outside when they finally materialize. So they go outside and investigate. It's this weird, craggy, sort of weird place. And they quickly find out, oh, my goodness, we've actually been shrunk, because they see things like a giant earthworm and a giant bee. But the thing is, all these insects they're seeing are all dead. It's weird. Even the ants.
30 seconds.
So they quickly find out that what's going on is there's this insecticide that's been deployed around this house, and the house actually belongs to a guy named Pharaoh who's developed. It belongs to a guy named Forrester. Actually, I don't know who the house belongs to. It belongs to someone, but basically they developed a insecticide that kills all insect life, not just the bad insects. And so this is very bad. But a guy named Forrester, who has helped fund developing it, shoots the inspector, a guy named Pharaoh. So he's committed murder, and therefore the Doctor and all his companions who are shrunk try to do their best to bring this person to justice, because they figure this out, even though Barbara's threatened with a fly that dies almost instantly when it touches the insecticide. But Barbara touches the insecticide, she's in trouble, so they have to rush back to the ship. And when the TARDIS enlarges, the poison in her system is so small it doesn't affect her, so she's fine. Plus, a cop comes to arrest the guy.
just about. Yeah. You, well done, first of all.
It was done. Let's be honest, Chris.
It's done.
I was a little too overconfident there. What happened was, it's kind of I got tripped up on the house, which was a dumb detail to get tripped up on. And it was kind of a grab bag of things that happened.
Yes.
But I think you can discern from the grab bag that most of the things that happened were pretty meh. The Shrinky's kind of fun, and the giant bugs are kind of fun. So I don't want to hate on this too much. There's fun stuff in this one.
Well, we should mention a couple of things you left out. The cliffhangers, and I think it's sort of telling that you left out the cliffhangers because they're so dumb. Right. They may, in fact, I would suggest be the dumbest cliffhangers in Doctor Who history. The first one is, oh no, it's a cat. Which sort of kind of takes us full circle in the classic series to survival, right? The cat people. But it just, you know, I couldn't look at that cat without thinking of the master and Bower the Doctor saying, you know, man's an experiment. The second cliffhanger is a guy washes his hands in a sink.
And again, I know it sounds dumb. You're kind of kicking this one a little bit while it's down. I admit, you know, like there's issues here, but those should be dangerous, right? Because if you put your brain in the minds of people who are shrunk, the whole idea is that everyday things become incredibly terrifying. Like a fly sitting there could kill you. The bee could. The worm could. All of these things, the cats certainly, and I'll get to the cat in a bit. So I can't hate it for that. And if I think about where this has been done right, if you've ever seen A Bug's Life, and the way they depict birds in that movie as monsters, but still clearly birds, kind of what they're going for here. So I get it. It's just when you're looking at it from a lens of us here in 2022, looking at 1963, 64 special effects. It's hard to get into it.
Yeah.
You know,
let me specify, cause I don't want to, you know, be the professor hater too much here, but, my issue is not necessarily the cliffhangers themselves. It's the resolution of them.
Yeah.
Right. So the resolution of the cat cliffhanger is the men of the TARDIS team tell the women of the TARDIS team not to look in the cat's eyes while they stare directly into the cat's eyes. And Barbara and Susan both have their sort of faces hidden while Ian and the doctor are like, "We're going to stare you down, cat. Don't look in its eyes, ladies, whatever you do."
Because it's going to know your women. Therefore weaker. No, that is like, it's, that was weird. Okay, let's go right into that one.
Yeah.
One here, there's that weird, you know, I can overlook the 60s sexism for I can correct for the time at the very least. Mm-hmm. But they never really say why not. Like why shouldn't I look into this cat's eyes? Even though I guess they're trying to imply that cats and animal dominance, you know, it tends to be like, if you look at an animal in the eyes, they tend to think you're trying to dominate them and will respond with a sort of a flight or fight instinct. And often it's fight.
Yeah. But it's not true with cats. It's true with dogs.
Yeah.
It's not absolutely not true.
For sure.
Cats, if you've ever tried to do a staring contest with a cat, you know that they're actually just really good at it. They enjoy it. And first of all, they don't get aggressive because of it. And in fact, what they'll do if they actually like you is kind of blink slowly in your direction.
Yeah.
So
that's a weird one. The other thing, the thing I just really find unrealistic here, having been an owner of two cats, is that the cat would even walk away. Cats freaking love to play with live things that are smaller than them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even if they're not hunters in the way that, you know, they want to kill mice or... I don't even know if they really want to kill mice or eat them that much, but they love to play with mice. They love to corner them.
Yep.
Bugs too, bigger bugs. My cats will, like, ever since I got my cats, I haven't had any bug problems in my basement because they will constantly just stomp them. And the cats just love to do that with smaller creatures. They do. That's why they're very good to have around.
Absolutely.
The fact that this cat would just walk away from these four people that are just kind of hanging out, that just would never happen. It would just never happen. The cat would
One of the least realistic things. By the way, we should talk about the cat while we're on the subject of the cat, and then we never have to mention the cat again.
It's the most famous cat in Doctor Who.
Right. Its name was Sammy.
Other than the master.
The character's name was Sammy. Like, the cat, it was given a name. The cat was supposed to die. So one of the first things we should say, and I just mentioned it briefly, this was supposed to be four episodes. The last two episodes were edited into one almost at the last minute. And one of the scenes that was removed was that the cat dies. The cat dies because of the insecticide. And that would be much more effective. I mean, perhaps maybe a little bit too far for the younger viewers. to yeah. see the cat die. But
also,
it was
in terms of scale, it doesn't make quite as much sense as the bugs dying, right? Like the cat would probably take a little longer to die, you would think, as a bigger
life. Right. Which is why he dies in episode 4. While they're in the lab, in the shed,
yeah,
I guess.
You have to presume it's been exposed to the pesticide for quite some time. Yeah. Okay.
And this is actually, so, we'll get into this a bit later, but this story was inspired by Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's book. And, you know, every creature that Rachel Carson writes about is mentioned here. So ants, flies, earthworms, I believe. It may also be in there, but cats. There are chapters on cats and how they were affected and died. You know, because they would step in insecticide and lick their paws and that would kill them.
Even absent that, I mean, I know that's I haven't read it or the details of it. I know it's obviously one of the most important works with regard to finding the problems with DDT and other insecticides. But the idea of it just sort of going up the food chain, which is always a huge issue. Like, you know, the more these tiny creatures eat things in trace amounts, you know, those get built up, the more bigger creatures. And then by the time it gets to humans, you know, this is the whole thing with mercury, et cetera. It's actually quite dangerous. Emphasizing that point would be pretty good. In fact, this is, again, I think, I don't want to jump ahead to our rating system, but the Doctor Who as education aspect to this episode is, it might be like the most unsubtle example of that we have done so far, because it's all over this one, you know, the cat eyes thing notwithstanding.
Right. So there's the cat, and let me just move on to the other cliffhanger and the problem with it, which is basically that it's reshot between you know, episodes 2 and 3. So the sink being pulled at the water is pulled at the end of episode 2, and you think that the Doctor and Susan are going to drown. But then it's reshot for the beginning of episode 3, and it's basically that the sink is still full, and they climb out of it before more water is poured in because the other guy has to wash his hands. So they're doing that thing that, you know, we sort of criticized the Mark of the Rani for. Remember at the end of episode 1 of Mark of the Rani? You know,
gurney or something?
He's on the gurney going into the mineshaft, and suddenly, you know, we introduce at the beginning of episode 2 a new thing we didn't see to stop the transit of the gurney into the mineshaft. So, it's, you know, that's not good cliffhanger behavior. It's not good now. It's not good then. It wasn't good. You know, people hated it in Saturday morning serials when they pulled things like that. So it just it's awful, not because, you know, cliffhanger is bloke washes his hands. It's also awful because it's reshot. And I also want to say that it's awful because there were much better cliffhangers in the original script as this was developed. And
do tell. I didn't read about this.
So this may well have been the story that followed An Unearthly Child. As it was first known in 1963, the episode An Unearthly Child, of course, we now know is followed by 100,000 BC, 10,000 BC. I forget how many zeros are before the BC. But An Unearthly Child was originally known as Nothing at the End of the Lane. And then it was going to be followed by this four-parter called The Giants. And what actually happened in that version is that the TARDIS team is miniaturized inside Coal Hill School.
Ah, okay.
So we all know the TARDIS team of Cliff, Sue, and Lola, which is how they were known then. Later became Ian, Susan, who was originally just a pupil, not the Doctor's granddaughter, and Barbara. So Barbara was originally Lola McGovern, which I love. Lola McGovern.
What an odd choice, though. Right? I mean, honestly, like, looking back, it's so incongruous with what we know as Doctor Who to sort of have this miniaturized episode as, like, the first thing. And what a different show might have resulted if that had been the case, right? Because it's like, now we know it's like, oh, all of time and space, everywhere and anywhere. But it is like you think about if they had made that choice, like that's just kind of weird sci-fi show, you know,
which is what they were sort of going for, right? As you know, it's the original remit by Sidney Newman, the Canadian producer who moved to the BBC with, you know, the remit to do more exciting drama. And this was one of them, exciting drama with a little bit of education. That was his idea. And it was one of the ideas that he thought about, was let's, you know, have one story where they get miniaturized.
Well, I read that they basically rejected this idea from the first season because they thought it wasn't conducive to good character development.
Yes. So it doesn't work as your second story after An Unearthly Child.
Because I guess you're just kind of too caught up in the sort of situational stuff that you get with like big things versus little things, et cetera. And the giant bug.
Yeah, and that was so they had a writer named C.E. Weber do a spec script basically on this, the Cornell School miniaturization, and while it was sort of it became clear to Sidney Newman when he read that there's no character development here. This is actually the wrong thing to do straight away, but it does have thank you, Canada. It does have better cliffhangers and better plot points. The first two cliffhangers would have rolled around pupils basically at the school preparing to kill them. One with an evil boy sharpening his compass, his compass point, and then there's a girl who puts them in a matchbox. It could have been kind of interesting. But one thing that version of the script did do that this does not is you have more interaction between the giant world and the tiny world.
Right.
Don't really have here. In there, they try to get under a school microscope.
I see. Okay.
So they could be seen. And they, instead of doing the whole thing with the telephone, now they try and lift up the telephone receiver again. Yeah. It's something we didn't really talk about in the summary. They get inside.
Stop criticizing my summary. I feel bad about it. Right.
we'll do it. We'll fix it in post. We'll fix it in post. They get inside a giant microphone.
So they can actually speak.
They can be played back at slow speed, I think was the idea.
Yeah, well, that is a good. I like those moments, and it does. That's kind of what this thing is missing. It's too bad they didn't at least take those elements from it. Obviously, that it would have been ruinous for the whole show if they had done this as the first episode. But that bit, like, here's not to get too far on a tangent, but a story that did that right, in my view, is the new Godzilla movie, the one that from about 10 years ago now, maybe a little longer, where it's almost two movies. There's the sort of macro scale movie of Godzilla and the micro scale of our human characters. And there's no real sort of interaction between the two, at least conscious interaction, until the very end, where the monsters sort of realize the specific human who's sort of working against them. And that's a great moment. When the two sort of worlds sort of become more aware of each other on that level, so that the fact that it's sort of lacking here is definitely a strike against.
It's almost two different dramas, basically. Well,
yeah. I'm also surprised that in both versions, the finished version or the four episode version of this, there was no thought of using the insect, the fly, as the cliffhanger, because that to me is like the moment, because they've had this careful they've had foreshadowing and an escalation of their interactions with the insects. First there's the dead earthworm, then the dead ants, then the just died bee. It actually just falls right in front of them, which is a little bit scary, and then it's the live fly, very much a live fly. That's a great reveal. And when you see it, like, you're kind of, there's enough there and it's moving. Yeah, it's a little robot-y, but it's like, you know, it's 1964, and you're kind of right in the mind of Barbara, like, holy crap, like, what do I do? Do I run? I mean, there's no way I could outrun this thing. Do I just stare at it? Do I back away slowly? Like, it's like the equivalent of a bear attack at this scale. And it's terrifying because we're all freaked out of bugs. Everyone, every human mm-hmm. is hardwired to be creeped out by these things, which is why, you know, creature features that feature giant bugs yeah. are tend to fascinate us. And that to me is kind of the money shot in a lot of ways. And so it sort of happens about halfway through episode two, I think.
Yeah.
But I was surprised they didn't use that as a cliffhanger.
Yeah, especially because we had the original movie of The Fly came out in 1958. So, you know, they would have known at this point that The Fly is absolutely terrifying, and you can do a lot with it in with that terror inside science fiction. And I think you're absolutely right about that. But yeah, I mean, miniaturization, we should also mention, was sort of on a lot of people's minds. We had the movie Fantastic Voyage coming up a few years later. I guess it's, you know, because everything was being miniaturized in terms of, you know, computers and electronics. It was the 60s was definitely the age of sudden miniaturization of everything. I guess it's natural to sort of extend that to humans as well, right?
Yeah, and I kind of think, I like your opinion on this. Do you think that has fallen out of fashion? Because to some extent, I think it never has fallen out of fashion because we're all kind of fascinated with the micro world on some level. Certainly more in fashion than the 60s and 70s, because if you think about comic books, you know, Ant-Man, and you know, I've got my
yes,
my giant man is a giant man in this one, but the Hank Pym shirt here to pay homage to the whole idea. Ant-Man is still a thing, but obviously, you know, the current version in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is based on those comics from the 60s and 70s, so I don't know if it counts, but it is still kind of interesting. But then you also had Inner Space. You ever remember that movie from the 80s, big hit with Dennis Quaid, Martin Short?
Yes. Yeah, that was almost a remake of Fantastic Voyage. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, so this miniaturization thing comes back again and again in pop culture. Do you think it is still fresh, can still be fresh, or is this all just sort of reverberating 60s, 70s nostalgia that we're still experiencing?
I think it can still be fresh. I think that one of the things that has exemplified that is the show Doctor Who, because of course, and we've seen a lot of it. We saw it in Carnival of Monsters. You know, that was all miniaturized in the miniscope. So, you know, whereas this, you know, Planet of Giants proved that you know, it's sort of static and kind of doesn't really work when you introduce it. You know, you sort of try to make the everyday a little bit creepy by miniaturizing people. You know, nice on paper, didn't actually work in practice. But in Doctor Who history, it's happened again and again. You've got Carnival Monsters, you've got Flatline, you've got... Yes.
Oh, that was so cool. Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it's not a lot of it, but the little things they do were so cool. Yeah,
and even the invisible enemy, which we the last story that we visited before we went random in Pull to Open History, you know, the Doctor himself is miniaturized.
And you mentioned it as you were racking your brain for Dalek episodes in the cold open here. But
into the Dalek.
Into the Dalek, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a big deal.
And of course, you know, in terms of miniaturizing people, we've got to give a shout out to the tissue compression eliminator.
Yeah.
Right? This is, yeah, you could almost see this as an earlier version of that. So miniaturization works, and it's creepy. And if you do it right, you know, it's right up. And, you know, the power of the Doctor showed us, I think, that the most tissue compression elimination in one scene, right, with all of the world's seismologists. That the Master has arrayed before him, yeah. You know. So it still works. It's still creepy.
There's a couple things I got to pick at a little bit here, just to get them out of the way. One, in terms of the miniaturization, one is that then the Doctor and Susan at one point climb up a corroded pipe to get up to that sink, and that just seems like, hold on a second, are you guys like Herculean mountain climbers? Because you're climbing up a vertical pipe. You'd be essentially like I think that just sounded like, okay, let's get there's mountain climbing on Gallifrey is like this, you know, Olympic sport that they just happen to be great at. That sounds really hard to me. So that took me a little bit out of the whole pipe thing.
Maybe William Hartnell is actually an action doctor off screen, you know, and that's why he's always exhausted when we see him.
So by the time we got to where they were evading the water and the cliffhanger, it didn't bother me as much, mostly because I was already taken out of that a bit, because it's like, well, clearly you're just doing things. you know, yep. like just to do them, and even, no matter how realistic or unrealistic they are.
Isn't it interesting the things that they chose to do, like the matchbox, the matches, the whole thing with matches is like very much of its era. Like, you know, we don't really carry around matchboxes anymore.
Well, you can still get them. I mean, it depends. Yeah. Like, I still use them when I'm like camping and things like that. So,
but also I feel like that this story should come with a warning for kids. You know, please do not try this at home. Do not turn on a gas tap and then stick an aerosol can in front of it. Right? <Yeah. laughs> You just wouldn't be allowed to show that today, because there would be too much fears of copycats and getting sued. And, you know, and the doctor he's kind of a pyromaniac here.
He is. Sorry, I remembered I didn't get to my second thing I wanted to pick out on the miniaturization, which was the notepad scene.
Yes.
You know, where they like, oh, we're on top of the desk and we got to decipher this notepad and figure out what it means. And it was one of those things where I think the script, the shooting script, and what they were doing on screen, like the scale of the set, that it was the right hand didn't quite know what the left hand was doing.
Yeah.
It was talking about, go all the way over there and read that out. And you go over there and read that out. And it's like, well, we could see it's a formula. It's a formula. Duh. Like, why don't you just stand over it? Because what they built is something you can just stand over and plainly see it's a formula.
It could have been so much worse. That was one of the things they cut when they squashed episodes 3 and 4 together, was long montage sequence of them walking up and down this notepaper and reading stuff out to the doctor, when you're absolutely right, the set has kind of negated that. And this is something we see a lot in Classic Who, that the costume design or the set is not really fully understanding what the script was going for, and I guess there isn't enough control being exerted by the producers over the whole process. But yeah, that's definitely an example of it.
But yeah, back to the doctor being a pyro.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
He's very much like, ooh, we're gonna, like, it's his plan, right? To basically turn on the gas and blow things up. And they kind of stayed at watch it happen, I think, because he wants to stay and watch it happen.
Yeah, this may explain why the doctor loves Ace so much in his seventh incarnation. You know, Ace is a bit of a pyro and loves blowing stuff up, and the doctor may recognize his younger self, his William Hartnell self, in her, because of course he does it in the Romans as well, which we've visited. Burns down Rome.
Maybe that wasn't so accidental after all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Burning down stuff left and right.
Maybe this is why he had to leave Gallifrey. You know, we haven't heard of all the pyromania that he indulged in as a kid. Yeah.
But I would say, like, I'm kind of glad the show even tried this early on. And I think, you know, as an exercise, like, I don't think there's anything really wrong with the special effects, judging it from the standards of the time, right? Like, I think they did fine. I think where this story falls down isn't that they tried to shrink people and try to sell it. I think they did their best there. And it actually, like, it's not bad. It's really that the story itself just they're kind of preachy, obviously. Like, there's such a black and white here with Forrester, if we want to talk about sort of this weird sort of gangster cops and robbers plot they have. And, you know, obviously there's a very, very unsubtle environmental message to it, but Forrester is just so bad. He's so black and white. He is this guy who's just willing to murder people for this insecticide that is going to murder people if it ever gets released. And it's so clearly there's zero gray to this one that you're just kind of, okay, I get it, they're gonna do this thing. Again, it was the 60s, it's Doctor Who's a little different, things were less shades of gray.
And the fact that he pulls out this teeny tiny little snub-nosed handgun.
Right.
You know, that's so, that's so a 60s thing. And you hear the audio sting from Dudley Simpson, by the way. I believe this is Dudley Simpson's first incidental music, of like, you know, that kind of, uh-oh, he just pulled out a gun. And it's just so comical today. Like, you know, that this guy obviously looks like a villain pulling out a very 60s, 50s villain kind of gun and threatening the good guy with it. You'll half expect him to be like, yeah, just go in the house, see? We're going to change your report, see? You wise guy?
Yeah.
You think you can get away with my DDT? Yeah, anyway.
DN6.
DN6, yeah, sorry. Keep forgetting the name.
Thinly veiled reference there, I believe is what they call that. So we mentioned the music briefly. This was actually the first story to feature the work, I guess, of Dudley Simpson as the composer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I was watching this with my kids, as I always do, and they noticed that the style of music, in terms of the instruments and that sort of musical cue you mentioned, was similar to Revenge of the Cybermen, right?
Oh.
I think that was Cary Blyton, who was very, very distinctive style, Cary Blyton. Like, in other words, like, I think what they noticed was that they were noticing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so I don't know if the style is really that comparable, but it is like one of these things where the cues are meant to sort of, they're meant to be intrusive and they're meant to sort of really hammer home points. But they did note that, especially Jack, that it worked in Revenge of the Cybermen and that didn't work here. They noticed it, but they didn't like it as much.
Yeah, it's kind of condescending. It's kind of like, hey, this is a kid's show. You know, we're going to have bouncy kids music, which just doesn't really work with Doctor Who. But, you know, it's an interesting that this happens with a new show. You find out what it can do and what it can't do. But to not to skip over the environmental message here, because I do want to highlight that, because you know, we've been to many environmental message stories here on Pull to Open.
Yep.
The Green Death, Inferno,
Fury from the Deep.
Well, it's interesting because it's something we normally associate with the Pertwee era, right, with Barry Letts, mm-hmm. and, you know, the sort of environmental consciousness of the 70s, and it's definitely more prominent then. But here we have the first environmental message in Doctor Who, unless you count, like, you know, the Daleks being kind of anti-nuclear war and this is what it's gonna happen, folks, if you have an irradiated landscape. But it's not like as in your face as this is. And it was consciously inspired by Silent Spring when they gave it to a new writer. So Louis Marx was the second writer on this. You know, the guy who did the treatment involving Cornell School was taken off the project. Louis Marx comes on. He'd just been reading about Silent Spring, which had only just been released in the UK in 1963. Said, of course, it was a huge sensation in the US. You know, there were TV documentaries on it and congressional hearings, and the chemical industry was pushing back really hard. Rachel Carson sadly died of cancer in 1964, about 6 months before Planet of Giants aired. It's kind of sad that that she didn't live to see it, but, you know, just an example of how it kind of permeated, but also an example of, like, Doctor Who being a little bit too contemporary, as it was also in you know, with Trout and the weed and the North Sea oil in Fury from the Deep. Like, it looks a bit dated now, right?
Yeah, it does, for sure. It's funny that this is sort of the first trip back to contemporary Earth for Ian and Barbara, and they're shrunk. You know,
yep.
I kind of like that idea, like, within the show, that we just can't get this right. They sort of retcon this a little bit in a short story. So, funnily enough, there is a sequel to it. not that anyone was dying to see one, but there is a sequel called House of Giants, which was a short story and actually puts it in the UNIT era. So,
interesting.
Sort of, I guess, maybe when just when switchboard operators were going out of style, perhaps.
Mm-hmm, Oh God, the switchboard operator. Yeah, it's so.
I hear you on the environmental stuff. Like, again, I think this is it's kind of okay for the 60s and sort of this unsubtle message. And a lot of Doctor Who was kind of that way, and a lot of entertainment was kind of that way. And I, you know, not to get too speculative, but I know we were talking about RTD in the last episode a bit, and I know he's talked a bit about some stuff he did with regard to the end of the world, and we haven't done that episode yet, but, like, he mentioned sort of global warming, the Doctor does, in a thing, and I think that's been sort of criticized. Anyway, not to talk too much about that, but I do feel like RTD maybe as part of a thing he wants to do in his new versions of Doctor Who, he's going to have something that addresses that more, I don't know.
More head on.
More head on. And more. Mm-hmm. I would say, I hope he doesn't look to this episode for that, is what I'm going to say, because it is just too black and white. I think the problem is Forrester is so bad.
Yeah.
And there's nothing made of, it is like, even if it's a flawed case, there's no case for this thing at all. Like, honestly, Forrester is a psycho, clearly. And he doesn't even care that he's going to kill himself, basically, with this thing. And we'll get to it in the What If the Evil Plot Had Succeeded. But it's like, I think there are shades of gray in environmental issues, right? If you're actually talking about them in a real world way. Mm-hmm. And you need to steel man things a little bit more if you're really going to have a successful show. And the fact that's kind of why I think this one doesn't really deliver. It just, I can't get into it too much, because it's just, I know, I get it. I get it from episode one.
You get it. And yet it's at the same time, I'm going to take issue that I would say it almost needs to be more unsubtle. There was a cut scene where Hartnell talks about how he can't stand by and watch a whole planet die. And you need something like that, where it's sort of clear that the scale of this potential tragedy is the entire planet. And it's kind of interesting, because it's a very un-Hartnell thing to say. You know, we sort of think of him as the Doctor who doesn't care too much and does run away. So that's what I have to say on that. I wanted to run through a few more things really briefly, kind of lightning round. One is the fact that Barbara is sick in the show. Like, she's, you know, she has some of the pesticide on her hands and get sick, and you know, that's, we can take issue with that, how that's resolved. But also, actually, behind the scenes, William Russell was the one who was sick. Barbara was just crazy. Acting. William Russell was actually sick during this, and like they had to taxi him home like immediately after they finished taping the last episode. So kind of makes a mockery of all this, sort of, you know, the men being strong and the women kind of being weak in this story. And then I just also briefly wanted to flag the submarine klaxon that we hear from the TARDIS beginning, which is sort of the first iteration of the cloister bell, I guess. How much cooler would the cloister bell would have been there?
They should retcon it, man. There should be a special edition of Planet of Giants.
I would actually go for that. Retcon the cloister bell into it.
Well, one more thing I want to zero in on before we get to the four questions is a lot of what sort of happens in episode 2 and 3 hinges on Barbara's decision to not tell anyone that she's touched the chemicals, which when you look at it now just seems so incomprehensible. Like, why wouldn't you just say something? I'm just curious, did that bother you as much as it sort of bothers me now? I think,
oh, totally. Yeah.
Even correcting for 60s behavior, which I admit, certainly people behaved differently back then, right? I think a show that really emphasizes this extremely well is Mad Men. That's one of, a big fan of Mad Men, because it sort of gets like how society has changed. And I like accurate sort of depictions of attitudes of different times. So I think even correcting for that, though, you know, what? Like, what are you doing? I all I can discern is that they're kind of trying to send a message to kids, like, don't keep a secret like this, because look what happens. I don't know. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that, and kids should take away the message that if you do touch pesticides, definitely tell someone. And it's definitely the 60s. It's also a pretty, very British attitude of like, oh no, don't mind me. Oh, yeah. I'm fine. I just need a little rest here. So I maybe bought it a little bit more than you did, because in many ways that attitude is still prevalent in the UK. I'm like, you know, minimizing illness.
Stiff upper lip.
Exactly. And we can see William Russell himself powering through through his sickness.
I never would have guessed. I had no idea until you told me. All right, Chris, I think it might be time.
I think it's time.
To cut to the four questions to Doomsday.
Man. Klaxon. Yes, sorry.
Okay, of course, question. Why did the randomizer take us here? What do you think?
Well, I think the randomizer just loves environmental messages. The randomizer may be even more of a hippie than I am.
Okay, it's not going to take us to arachnids in the UK next, yes.
Oh, God.
I guess we're going to do it at some point.
It is now you said that. Yeah.
Speaking of bugs and creature features, right?
I would also suggest that maybe the randomizer saw Power of the Doctor and wanted more William Russell.
Hey, I like that. Who wouldn't?
Right? I mean, it's so cool that he was in that, and he's, what, 90 now? It's so crazy to see.
97. I think 97. He might have been 96 when he actually filmed it, but yeah.
Wow. That's so wild. And he's still in it. And to see that and then go straight to this, that was quite the timey-wimey moment.
Yeah. I'm just going to take credit because I'd said, take us to Big Beasts.
You did.
Like, yeah, that's it. This is it.
Yeah. The extent to which Beast Below was also an environmental message of, be nice to whales, y'all. This was, don't spray chemicals, y'all. Yeah. So I think we got it. Randomizers nailed it.
All right. Second question. What if the evil plot had succeeded?
Well, if the evil plot succeeds and DN6 spreads across the planet and starts killing people off, and the Doctor hasn't been able to save us, then I think there's only one person on the planet who can. She's Canadian. Her name is Joni Mitchell. Purveyor of the most popular song to contain the words DDTs. In Big Yellow Taxi, of course. Hey, farmer, put away those DDTs now. I think that Joni is going to have to release that song early or late, or re-release it, depending on which dating timeline we're on for this. But that's my what if the evil plot succeeded. Joni Mitchell has to save the planet.
Wow. I think, that we'd have to lead on Clara to, one of their splinters, which is, of course, the next question to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was... zeroing in on, I'm really interested to hear that cut line because, I think the stakes here are a little understated. And if you think about it, so here's how that would succeed. The gang doesn't get the phone off the hook. The cops aren't, but doesn't pique the suspicions of the phone operator. The cops don't arrest Forrester. And therefore, his plot succeeds and DNC is approved for release. Or sorry, DN6. And what that does is just catastrophic damage to the ecology based on what they said. It's like, quote unquote, everlasting, kills all insect life, which would probably, before they could do anything about it, there'd be more famine and death all over. So you kind of have this weakened Earth now, assuming it's wide scale enough that it's either a weakened Earth or one that's a little more dystopian.
Right.
Pick your invasion or pick your bad guy who takes advantage of that situation.
So we kind of get turned left like 40 or 50 years early.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. I kind of like that idea.
It's trouble.
Yeah. You just reminded me that I have issue with the everlasting thing, which is just like, that's not a thing. In science, stuff doesn't last forever. Second law of thermodynamics, it would break down eventually. Maybe it's millions of years. Maybe it's like strontium 90 or something. It's really hard to see the through line on this, which is really why you need Hartnell to say something like that. It's hard to see how this affects the entire planet. Unless, all of the militaries of the Earth immediately spray the entire agricultural land of the planet with DN6, they're so convinced by Forrester, and there's nothing wrong with it. He doesn't look like an evil guy, so they completely believe him. They believe this hastily rewritten report that he might as well have scratched out parts in crayon and added stuff. I mean, it just really, it's basically like that time that Trump did the hurricane with the, he extended the line of the hurricane to prove himself right. That's basically Forrester's plan here. Like, oh, I'm just going to write in, I'm going to cross out a line and be like, ignore this. Change my mind.
Terrible impersonation over the phone that even in the crackly operator's earpiece Super Analog. That's not the same guy. What? Yeah.
His evil plot is to put a handkerchief over the receiver when he talks on the phone. It's crazy.
Yeah. So terrible as the plot succeeds, highly unlikely it does, even if they don't get the phone off. So I think we can at least throw that in. All right. Third question. Where is the Clara Splinter here?
You know, she could be all over the place. Like she could be distracting the cat. Maybe that would explain the cat plot hole. She's like in a staring contest with the cat, and then, you know, kind of throws some kibble to make it run away, or releases a bunch of moths from a matchbox, and the cat's like, "Ooh, moths! Much more interesting."
Nice. Yeah, I'm going with that. That's way better. All I could think of, I don't know why I didn't think of the cat. That's a great one. She poked the cat away somehow. Maybe she was a mail carrier. I don't know. But I only thought she was like a friend of the operator, maybe, who was like, you might want to listen closer. Like maybe either directly on that call or just generally as her. Is gossiping with her and makes her more suspicious overall. Because she's kind of like, I guess operators did that, but I always feel like when I hear about operators listening into calls, like, that's a little, like, weird.
Well, this was the thing about party lines, right? You know, you not just have operators listening in, but also, like, you know, neighbors would often be on the same line. It's interesting. Hilda definitely doesn't get enough respect in this episode because she basically brings the whole evil plot crashing down. So good on you, Hilda, the telephone operator.
Yeah. All righty. Now, the final question. Is this episode a Dalek, which is the rating we have for good episodes? Is it an Ogron, which is the rating we have for perhaps not so good episodes? A Professor Hater, which is a not so good episode, but at least we learn something? Or a Viscount Banger? Do I even have to say?
No.
Viscount Banger? Obviously.
Definitely not a Viscount Banger. No. But I'm going to say I was thinking this is a tiny Ogron. But no, I think the more we talk through it, the more I think this is a teeny, teeny, tiny miniaturized Professor Hater. We learned from it.
I think I'm with you there. I had a tough time deciding, honestly, because I got to say, like, this episode probably more than other 60s episodes requires some correction for the time and both in the storytelling effects and everything. So I was willing, and I do remember watching it way back in the day and enjoying the idea,
yes, you
know, with the bugs and stuff. But I don't think it ever quite delivers even by the standards of the time in terms of storytelling. And again, like, I don't know why you wouldn't use that fly as like your cliffhanger or do a little more with it. Again, like, you know, you don't, a better action sequence is perhaps too much to expect. Even when you look years later at the Green Death, it's not like they did a whole hell of a lot more
with their fly. Yeah. And this is definitely a more impressive fly.
Yeah. So it kind of like on its own terms, it's almost a Dalek, albeit a very small Dalek. But I think ultimately it's ultimately a Hater, you know.
You kind of
learn a little something.
You learn what Doctor Who shouldn't be, which is sort of our criteria for the Professor Hater. Like it's instrumental in sort of giving us an example of why what doesn't work in a Doctor Who context. Mm-hmm. And I think we sort of have that all over the place here.
Yeah, totally agreed. All right, sir.
All right.
Time to enlarge this podcast back to regular size and figure out where we are going next.
Hopefully indeed.
We'll get rid of some toxins in our bloodstream at that time. It's time to activate the randomizer. The randomizer,
indeed,
of course, as listeners know, consists of two parts. The Pull to Open Codex, which is a list, a spreadsheet, a newly upgraded spreadsheet that has every single episode of the television series Doctor Who in sequential order, all the way from An Unearthly Child to The Power of the Doctor. It's 302 episodes. And
that's right. Well, 302 discrete stories. And the other part of the codex is random.org.
The other part of the randomizer is.
Yes. Random.org, which is using atmospheric noise rather than computer algorithms to truly generate randomness. And the method by which we think the Doctor may be communicating with us. So I have the minimum number of 1 and the maximum number of 302 plugged into random.org. And once we have issued challenges to the randomizer, mm-hmm. I will then hit the generate button and we will find out where we're going next. So Pete, do you have any challenges?
Sure. I'm going to do Triple Yahtzee and I'm going to say, just take us to Arachnids of the UK already. Just do it. Let's just get it out of the way. I feel like we got to get the bug features all out of the way. And we've already done the Green Death. Now we've done Planet of the Giants.
More bugs.
None of them come to mind except for that Whitaker outing. So let's just do it. Let's get it over with.
More bugs, spelled M-O-A-R. I'm going to recycle a point I was going to mention during the show, but I'm going to use it as a challenge. So Planet of the Giants may be the weakest opening for any Doctor Who season, because it was, so you know, and they sort of knew it at the time, right? They wanted Dalek Invasion of Earth, which comes next, to be the season opener, but they couldn't because Susan leaves at the end of that. So so they're kind of locked into using this. So take us to the best season opener. I don't know what that is, but like, just take us to a story one in a season, and we will presume that it is your choice for best season opener.
Nice. I like it. That's going to be cool. I can't wait to see the randomizer respond to you in 4 to 8 weeks' time.
Exactly, right. Exactly. In 4 to 8 business days, the randomizer will get back to us.
Shall we roll these cosmic dice?
Let's do it. Give me a countdown.
Let's do it in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Halsey. 189. I think we're in New Who.
New Who. We are definitely in New Who. Oh, dude.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
Don't blink.
We got there. Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Man.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. You know, I'm going to have my eyes propped open on matchstocks the next week.
Weird coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually recently watched it.
Ooh.
My daughter, it was just my daughter and I, which was interesting because it's
so scary.
My son a while to get the courage to watch this one. He did it a year or two ago, but my daughter was into it, and this was sort of during the Halloween season, and it was fun. It was a really fun one to watch with her, and this will be cool. I'm going to watch it again for the podcast and
indeed
more. But
indeed,
this is it. I mean, this is Blink. It's legendary. I mean, come on.
It is. I mean, what is there left to say about Blink? You know, it is definitely the one that I show people who are not into Doctor Who to try to get them into Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Dalek is good for some things, but Blink, like Dalek, masterclass in revealing a large amount of information in a short space of time. Masterclass in TV writing.
I think it's one of those things. I mean, we've both written about it, I'm sure.
Yep.
I wrote about it briefly as one of the must watches when I was compiling,
mm-hmm.
like, though anyone who wanted to get up to speed on Doctor Who, what are the episodes you have? This is before the 50th anniversary special. What are the episodes you have to watch? And Blink, how could I leave it off? I mean, like,
yep.
It's not just a great episode of Doctor Who. It's just a great episode of television.
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. This will be something. Okay, folks. Well,
all right.
We're going to blink out of this podcast. I can't even. It's just not worthy. It's not. I shouldn't even try. Guys, we're going to leave this podcast when we're going to get mentally prepared for our next one, which will be Blink. And remember, this is a podcast. So please, if you have not done it yet, go ahead and subscribe. Go ahead and share the podcast with your friends. Can tell them, hey, they're going to talk about Blink next time.
That's right.
Listen, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to us. Those really do help the show. Follow us on social. Pull2Open on TikTok. Pull2Open63 on Twitter and Instagram. Pull2Open on... Pull2Open anything. I don't know. We're everywhere.
Anything. We're either Pull2Open or Pull2Open63.
All right. We're... YouTube.com/bolt to open. I really have a list of these when I do them.
I just want to say to any weeping angels out there, please leave us a review, because no one is looking at you right now. I'm sure it's okay. You can move. You can move now. Move towards Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. Thanks, weeping angels.
Don't look at each other. We'll see you next time.